I hope the information that I've provided so far is helping you to see and understand the other side of the false narrative that we're constantly being bombarded with from the CDC and the mainstream media, that the COVID vaccines are safe and effective and that everyone should get them to protect us all from COVID. Truthful side is that these vaccines are not safe or effective. They are literally a risk to life and limb, as we can see from the real data that is pouring in. This episode focuses on the risk and harm to women and children. We'll discover more of the effects that women and children are experiencing in both the vaccinated and unvaccinated, including potential long-term effects, the lack of actual real science to support the safety of vaccinating children, how vaccine testing is junk science, what the true data from both historical vaccines and COVID shots, when properly analyzed, really tells us about the health differences between the vaccinated and unvaccinated, both then and now, and we'll see how the advisory council and immunization practices cherry picks data and spins the numbers to make poor data look good, and then the CDC uses it to justify giving children the COVID injection.
There are no genotoxicity studies, no teratogenicity studies, so we have no business ever having a pregnant woman become vaccinated. There's a concerning biodistribution study from Pfizer demonstrating hyperconcentration in the ovaries. There's a concerning fertility study from Moderna showing reduction in fertility in animals. Again, no safety guardrails. There's been no restriction of the properly excluded groups from the randomized trials. Pregnant women, women of childbearing potential, COVID survivors previously immune, they were all appropriately excluded from the randomized trials because they have no opportunity to benefit. The FDA and the manufacturers knew they couldn't benefit, and there's only an opportunity for harm. And in fact, that's what we've seen. There's been no effort to restrict vaccination according to risk of hospitalization and death. You know, in every other vaccine, we have a narrow application when it's needed. For instance, pneumococcal vaccine in seniors, or meningococcal vaccine before the kids go to school for college. But we don't blanket the entire population, as has been done in this mass vaccination program. And there's been zero attempts to mitigate risk to the public. We are 6 months into this, and there's still yet to be a first press briefing by the US FDA and CDC to disclose safety to Americans, comprehensive safety to Americans. And this is absolutely alarming. This should have been happening every month. And we know that we're in trouble. We had a safety signal as of January 22nd, where the mortality was already 182 deaths. They had already exceeded the national average of 158 with all vaccines combined, about 500 million shots. And this happened with only about 2% of the U.S. population vaccinated. So we had a safety signal at the end of January. And I think if we had the proper Data Safety Monitoring Board, this program would have been shut down in February. I've chaired over two dozen Data Safety Monitoring Boards, including those for the National Institutes of Health. And I can tell you, if I was overseeing this safety program, I would have shut it down in February. Shut it down because of safety. Look at the skyrocketing mortality that's happened with vaccination. It's unquestionably the most dangerous vaccine that we've ever seen in human use. Now, here we were as of June 11th, you can see 6,000 deaths. These have now shot up to 9,000 deaths with contemporary reporting. But just to give you a framework, for all 70 vaccines, we get about 16,320 total safety reports per year. We're already at 358,379 verified safety reports from the CDC. Over 20,000 hospitalizations. You can see over 100,000 urgent care ER visits. These numbers are extraordinary, and these are the ones certified by the CDC with permanent VAERS numbers. There is a giant backlog of many more to come. So the safety data has basically taken all the enthusiasm out of the vaccine program. The safety events are strongly related to when the injection occurs. We have analyses now from Rose that demonstrate that about 50% of the deaths, for instance, occur within 48 hours of injection, 80% occur within a week. They're very strongly temporally related. Another analysis from McLachlan and colleagues show that 86% of the deaths are due to the vaccine itself. They can't be explained away by other problems. The evidence-based consulting group, which is the principal contract consultant to the World Health Organization, led by Dr. Tess Lowry, has basically called for withdrawal of the vaccines from the market. The conclusion is they are not safe for human use, and it makes a lot of sense based on the safety data. Now, the good news with vaccines is there may be a better, safer vaccine on the way. The Novavax vaccine top line results, an initial paper was just published. It looks every bit as good as Pfizer and Moderna, except for much safer. It's a limited amount of antigenic spike protein like a tetanus booster and no genetic manipulation of cells. So Novavax looks quite good as we sit here today. So to finish and conclude, the COVID-19 pandemic is a global disaster. Its pathophysiology is complex. Despite contagion control, there have been two poor outcomes, hospitalization and death. It took clinical leadership to identify hospitalization and death as a bad outcome and stay laser focused on treating outpatients in order to handle the problem. And that's what myself and other key leaders that I've mentioned during this talk did. We did not have a single government body, not a single government expert, not a single academic institution take a leadership role in handling the pandemic. It was all done by hero doctors, many of which you've learned through your course of presentations on this program. Pre-hospital phase is the time for therapeutic opportunity. Hospitalization and late treatment is simply too late. It's unacceptably high mortality. Early ambulatory therapy with sequenced multi-drug approach supported by the best available evidence has a positive benefit to risk relationship. Reduces hospitalization and death, allows us to temporize to close out the pandemic. The COVID-19 genetic vaccines have an unfavorable safety profile and cannot be generally supported in clinical practice at this time. And there's more bad news in that we now have variants, the Delta variant, the Lambda and Epsilon. They are widely escaping the effects of the vaccine. The vaccines have now been basically rendered ineffective in handling the pandemic. And I think it'd be reasonable at this point in time to go ahead and close down the vaccine program.
Wow, fantastic, thank you. That is absolutely riveting in the various aspects where this early treatment, like coming back to this early treatment, so because we are contending the vaccine, we are seeing adverse reactions, we are seeing massive issues, but we're also seeing that the problem that we're in right now where we're pushing for this vaccine has to do with the fact that a lot of people aren't aware that there are early treatments that are available, that are effective, that work, that reduce mortality significantly. And so this is key information. So a few things that I think would be great to chat about would be some of the challenges here. Like when it comes to pregnant women, the fact that pregnant women have been told that they can have this vaccine, and I have a cousin that had a miscarriage, she was a nurse and she had the vaccine. She was told that she had to have the vaccine. She's pregnant and she had a miscarriage. And these are stories that keep coming up. Obviously, it's completely horrifying and sad. And obviously, I do believe in the correlation between these things is very likely. I can't prove it in this particular case, but many reports coming out of this nature. The thing that I have I get an eerie feeling about is the fact that there was no study done on this, so you have to do the study in order to tell pregnant women they can have the vaccine. So how do you answer that? Why would that be told that was safe and effective when no trial had been done? That starts to sound malicious. I don't know what to think. How do you understand something like this?
I've never told a pregnant woman it's safe to take the vaccine, and it's good clinical practice to always assume new products are dangerous in pregnancy until proven to be safe. In fact, we have pregnancy categories A, B, and C on all new products in order to kind of regulate our determination of safety. And the FDA agrees. The FDA and the manufacturers excluded pregnant women or even women who could not guarantee contraception. They were excluded from the randomized trials. So the FDA agrees. And even the CDC agrees in executing the program in the United States. You know what the consent form says? The consent form at my hospital, I read it. There's a whole section. It says, check here. I am not pregnant and I should not get pregnant for some time after the vaccination. So women actually have to give assurances that they're not pregnant. So I put a lot of this on the woman. If a woman is pregnant and the consent form says you should not be pregnant, the woman should actually set down the consent form and walk out of the vaccine center. Women should not be signing up for this. You know, a lot of women who are pregnant, they won't even drink half a glass of wine. How in the world would they just walk into a vaccine center and take a shot of experimental, you know, gene transfer technology with messenger RNA or adenoviral DNA? We now know that the spike protein is generated. We know it's dangerous. It damages blood vessels. It causes blood clotting. That's the last thing you want circulating to the placenta or to the baby. It's been a wrecking machine. And so women need to wake up. Pregnant women need to wake up and understand, don't do that. It's just like you wouldn't do cocaine or do terrible drugs. Don't walk into a vaccine center when you're pregnant. So I kind of put this on the women. Now, the doctors who are advising patients to get the vaccine, that's a whole different kettle of fish. Those doctors need to kind of come out of their trance and realize that we always assume something's dangerous until proven beneficial. And it won't be many years before we ever know if these are beneficial or not. And I can tell you, as a doctor, I consult on women who are pregnant. I would never do this in my career, never. And I just think it's one of these absolute disasters to ever have a pregnant woman get one of these vaccines. We can treat COVID-19. If a pregnant woman happened to have severe symptoms, we can sequence the drugs. We can use hydroxychloroquine during pregnancy. We can use azithromycin. We can use steroids. We can use aspirin. We can use blood thinners. It's an easily treatable problem in pregnancy. Why risk the vaccine?
Ivermectin would be one of those as well, or not?
Well, I have less information about using ivermectin in pregnancy. It's so broadly used in so many conditions. It's just that hydroxychloroquine specifically has data in pregnant women as positive.
Yeah, fantastic. And I believe the numbers are 4 billion applications of ivermectin over 3 decades and 2 reported deaths, which also make me wonder whether the drug could be attributed based on the number ratios of how abnormal those numbers are, 4 billion to 2. It does then make I go the other way then of seeing, hey, that those death, this may have 0 deaths on its record, so it may be safe, but I get that we don't have a study, so we actually shouldn't recommend that it is safe, but let people know the data. That's very helpful.
You're right. I don't have any concerns, just like I wouldn't have concerns with the other drug I mentioned, but I have deep concerns with the vaccines. Remember, the vaccines were specifically not tested to see if they cause birth defects or if they influence mental development of the baby. How could a woman possibly consider ever taking one of these injections and risking herself and risking the baby? It's unconscionable. And I put this on the woman. The woman, a pregnant woman, must know that this is brand new. They must know it's not fully FDA approved. And they must read the consent form, which says you should not be pregnant when you get the vaccine.
Another incredibly concerning side effect, which affects me personally because I have 2 young adult daughters, is that we're seeing fertility issues. We're seeing menstrual cycle issues. We're seeing all sorts of problems, very bizarre menstruation after the vaccine, miscarriages after the vaccine, which should not be ever given to pregnant women, by the way, but unfortunately pregnant women are getting it. So what do you do when you find out that a family member has done this? It's really hard not to feel incredibly worried. And I think that there's something to worry about, I do. I also think that if you're healthy and you don't need the vaccine and you were gonna get COVID, you were gonna recover and have no problems from having it, which is not to say that COVID can't be really, really bad. Of course it can, and we've had a lot of people die from it. But at the same time, the vaccine can be really, really bad, and now we're seeing way more deaths from the vaccine than we're seeing from COVID. All of that said, if someone is healthy and they get this vaccine, it's not necessarily going to harm them. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what's going to happen right now, and we don't know what's going to happen in the future. But I'm hopeful that we're overestimating how bad some of the side effects may be. And I'm saying that with my fingers crossed, because honestly, the only accurate scientific thing that anyone can say about that is that we don't know. This is technology that has never been used before in this form. How can we know what's going to happen when, for example, people who have gotten the vaccine are then exposed to COVID? What doctors are fearing is something called pathogenic priming, which is when you actually, we've seen this with the dengue fever vaccine. So Dengue fever is something that that is a big problem in places like the Philippines. The Philippines rolled out a huge campaign to vaccinate children against dengue fever. It turned out that children who were vaccinated against dengue fever, who then got exposed to dengue fever, actually had much, much worse outcomes. And they stopped the campaign. They don't do it anymore. They're not doing it universally. And people are afraid that that's what's also going to happen with this COVID-19 vaccine. Only time will tell. There's a really good article on NPR that was published by NPR, and it's called like Goats and Soda or something. It's that it's a health section of NPR. I'm not 100% sure. I feel like it was 2017, 2018. I mean, it was very recent with dengue fever. And it's worth looking it up. And I might have gotten a detail wrong about that because I think it might have been that children who had been exposed to dengue fever and then got the vaccine, if they got exposed again, there were hundreds of deaths. And the parents begged the government to find out what had killed their children. I mean, you can see these pictures of the parents holding, you know, the pictures of their children who died. And the government, to their credit, stopped the universal vaccination program. Unfortunately, the FDA, it's called Dengavax, and the FDA approved that vaccine in the United States. It's not used regularly because we don't have dengue fever. But in light of the fact that it did so much damage, I don't think that vaccine should have been FDA approved.
Even postmenopausal women, even people who have been on chemotherapy and in their 80s, all of a sudden bleeding. We've had children and even 18-month-old toddlers bleeding from their vagina after being in close proximity. This is absolutely happening. We have tens of thousands of cases. When I asked any of my group and members, has anyone had any problems like this? I had over 700 responses within 12 hours. It's unbelievable, just in the United States alone. Just my close colleagues, when they're working in their clinics, they reported back to me that they were getting strange rashes and, you know, abnormal bleeding. And this bleeding that they're getting is extremely abnormal. It's not just a bad period. They're getting something called a decidual cast, which is like an imprint of the entire uterus, which we've never seen before. We only read about. This is brand new. That alone should stop everything. Because what is happening to the reproductive capabilities of us? Also, we know that people who are in their early stages of pregnancy, the first trimester, in some places we're seeing almost a 400 times increase of miscarriages in the first trimester. Something is causing that. That just started happening within the last few months. This is not coincidence whatsoever. The sad thing is these reports keep going on, and they're being ignored by the CDC, the World Health Organization, all of our medical institutions, all the universities, all the hospitals. They're completely ignoring this. There is another motive, another agenda, because this is not in the name of science. It's not in the name of humanity. So we have to start looking at this. We need to start speaking up for ourselves, because what will happen to us in 5-10 years if this really is affecting our reproductive capabilities? So what is going on? Well, the short answer is not one of us know. And the problem is we have experimental agents inside the vials. Another problem is, how do we know what's inside the vials? None of us are allowed to analyze the contents. I think we should be able to analyze it. If they have nothing to hide, these manufacturers, why can't we look at it? Especially since none of the manufacturers have any liability for any ill will, anybody that's killed or maimed or hurt. They don't pay a penny out. They have been making record number of profits in the name of the experimentation on humanity. And meanwhile, the people are suffering and they have no recourse. So what makes, they have no, what is the incentive for them to make anything safer? There isn't, because they still make money. They don't have to put any extra money into making it safer. Who's overseeing the production and the quality control of these vials? Nobody that I know of. So right now, we should put a moratorium, analyze the vials, look what's inside of them, see what could be happening, because we all are just guessing. And then perhaps we can start to heal people that have been damaged from this. We do know there's a possibility of the spike protein being transmitted. We don't know that, though. That's a possibility. We know that the spike protein itself is can damage the body all on its own, even though it's not alive. Also, there's a concern about EMF. There's a electrical transmission that could be going on, because we're also now dealing with some nanolipid particles, which is also a form of nanotechnology. And that's something that has to be investigated. These are just hypotheses, but we need to look at the vials.
Wow. Thank you, Dr. Mate. And some of the evidence is that something is willfully being done here. One would be the parameters of people that were in the original case study or a clinical trial to test the vaccine were not allowed to have sex without a condom. Is that correct as you understand it? And then, so it was not testing the reproductive elements or willfully wanting this information not to be a part of that versus wanting to see if that could be an issue. And the other one would be to recommend to pregnant mothers or to babies or children that study would have to happen. Women that were pregnant would have to be given the vaccine, and that's just not going to happen. I don't know many women that would do that, but certainly, well, I suppose there probably would be some, but the issue there is that the studies need to be done, but they're not being done, and yet it's been told that it's safe and effective. So for me, that's a big alarm bell. What would you say to that?
One thing I forgot to say was that in Pfizer's protocol, they have a section there where they said that any vaccinated individual that comes in close contact with a woman that is trying to get pregnant, is pregnant, or breastfeeding, they should report that incident immediately to Pfizer, and they will be followed. The reason they said was that there was a possible transmission that could occur from the vaccinated to the unvaccinated, and it could affect the baby. Wait a minute. That is a true statement that is in Pfizer's protocol. What in the world are we doing giving this to pregnant women, giving this to women who are breastfeeding, and giving this to children, when in the protocol they absolutely said there's a danger? That shows you that something massively deceptive is going on, and that we are not following first do no harm protocols. So that's from Pfizer's own protocol. And also they've said that in Pfizer and Moderna that anyone who gets this injection called a vaccine, that they should not have unprotected sex for 28 days because of the risk of birth defects. I don't hear anyone talking about that in the major media, nor do I hear that being given as a warning to people in the clinics and the hospitals right now. They don't even know that. And what happens on the 29th day? They're automatically just protected, or nothing will happen? Again, we're going off very little data, and people have to remember that these injections were made in less than a year, when it takes usually 10 to 15 years to make something like this. This is record time using brand new technology.
It's information that I can see this leaves people like yourself in a position where when data is being ignored or it's being positioned in such a way that we don't want this information to come out, it makes us arrive at those conclusions to not be allowed to have sex without a condom for 28 days. And so that those findings don't come out. It makes us think that that's intentional versus an accident. And so from that, this idea of something being coming out for some kind of sinister purpose, because of the censorship, many people are not getting this information, and we believe it's critical to be able to keep your health during these times. And so it's through this resource we believe that we can help change and save lives. And so you owning this series and having it in your home so you can have it for your friends, for your family, to be able to share this resource, be able to equip yourself, I believe is critical. And when you own it, you also get access to the new information that we're putting out, which is amazing. We're able to keep you up to date and plug you into a system, a community that gives you the information that you're needing as we turn the next corner and we navigate. And I have all these experts to call upon for the next steps, and you get new additional information. So thank you so much for hearing me on that and for considering supporting our mission. Just know that we are not able to get this information into the world outside of supporters such as yourself, because we do not get funding from any other source or sponsors or any other companies. We are reliant on people believing in our work, getting value from it, having it change and transform their lives, and giving back to us to be able to continue to create more resources by just simply owning this series here with the silver or the gold package of Vaccine Secrets COVID Crisis. That allows us to continue to help you and to create more resources and to continue this amazing work of advocacy in these times of unprecedented censorship and such an information war of lies and deception. So we're here for you, and I appreciate you taking the time to listen to this. Let's pray that people wake up in time so that we, no more damage is done. And so now come to the myocarditis issue. So, and youth, like there's a huge issue there. Israel was a rollout where lots of cases have been reported of young people having these issues. And I checked Vayas myself with the 12 to 17 year olds, and it was just really sad. I saw in 1 week, it was just this past couple of weeks, in 1 week it was 14 deaths, and it was very sad to read all the different deaths. And there were some unusual things that were reported in there. One was a suicide, and or two were suicides in that week. And then I also thought about there was a an actor, Ben Stein, talked about when he got the injection that he had severely irrational thoughts. And then I also thought, one of the youth were on medication and the other one wasn't, and both of them were suicide, and I did think about that as well. I did think about some of these other things that we're not talking a lot about, the possibility of mental health episodes in connection to this, and then I'm thinking about other issues as well with cancer, because that's not talked about. And for me, I think that should always be a concern, especially when autoimmunity is concerned, because studies that I've looked at have shown that if you have autoimmune disease, you're 5 times more likely to get cancer. And that is, yeah, please, I'd like to hear.
Okay, let's take myocarditis. There's an official warning by the FDA on the messenger RNA vaccines for myocarditis. The current number that the CDC has verified is 2,000 cases now. Tip of the iceberg. A few weeks ago, they thought they had 200. Tends to occur in younger people. Again, younger cells probably take up more of the messenger RNA, spike protein produced in cardiomyocytes, satellite cells, causes inflammation, causes heart muscle damage. The clinical presentation is chest pain, EKG changes, elevations in cardiac troponin, a test of cardiac injury, to a very high level, much higher than a heart attack, by the way. And then the signs and symptoms of heart failure, and we actually can see the heart beginning to fail on echocardiography in about 25% of individuals. The CDC, when they reviewed this in the week of June 23rd, had about 200 cases. 90% of the kids had to be hospitalized. They had reduced pumping function about a quarter. They had to go on heart failure medications. That means no activities in school and heart failure medications for 3 to 6 months in a reassessment. I've seen these patients in my office. It's real. I've been on national TV. Now, when I go on national TV, keep in mind, I'm the most authoritative doctor that America has, right? So I've seen and examined hundreds of patients. I've advised on many hundreds more, if not 1,000. I have the most peer-reviewed publications. I'm the most published person that you'll see on TV. I had COVID-19 myself. I've had family members in my family have COVID-19, including fatal cases. I think in a single person, I am the most authoritative person to guide people on this. And I've told America very clearly, no one under age 30 gets the COVID-19 vaccine, full stop. There should be no reason why a 13-year-old kid comes in. This was presented on national TV where he gets fatal myocarditis in a few days. There's been a young African-American woman, a teenager, who goes all the way to heart transplant and dies. This should not be happening, full stop. No kids get the vaccine, period. If they feel forced by their schools, dispute it and show up anyway and say it's under dispute. Sorry. Full stop. We just cannot do this. There's no other safe way around it. We can't fool around with this. Now, the neurologic complications, they occur: optic neuritis, blindness, whole variety of cerebellar cerebral symptoms, cervical myelitis, paralysis, Bell's palsy, half the face being paralyzed. Now, yesterday, US FDA official warning puts out there that now Guillain-Barré syndrome, ascending paralysis, is now officially associated with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. But it doesn't stop there. Blood clotting. We know AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson have warnings age 18 to 48 for blood clotting, serious blood clotting, particularly in women. Where do the blood clots form? In the brain. It's called cavernous venous thrombosis. Very difficult to deal with once it occurs. Again, women in this age group, age 48 and down. Now, this is even a broader group. Under no circumstances should receive the COVID-19 vaccines. These vaccines, again, have no opportunity for benefit, only the opportunity of harm. And then lastly, these immunologic syndromes. And what have we seen? It's called multi-system inflammatory disease, MISC. This can be associated with the myocarditis, but it can occur independently. And it's a real problem. It's organ inflammation throughout the body. It was initially reported by Kaiser Permanente in California. We have plenty of spontaneous event reporting indicating these are all tip of the iceberg. These are massive problems. Again, these are in a sense, telltale indicators that our federal agencies have basically committed malfeasance, this wrongdoing by those in authority, to not be transparent on safety and not make the important product recalls early.
Okay, I'm so thrilled to be here today with Dr. Paul Thomas, and he is an amazing individual that has done such amazing work for so long, especially in the area of children and understanding vaccine safety. And this has truly been perhaps the most challenging area in medicine and the health of our population, especially our children, but that's the formative years. So that becomes essential. That's the building blocks for our future. And Dr. Thomas is well-equipped to be able to answer all of our challenging questions.
I've been a pediatrician for 35 years, have been board certified all of those years. I'm also trained in integrative holistic medicine. I'm board certified in addiction medicine, but I'm primarily a pediatrician. That's my love. That's my pediatric practice where I've been for over 13 years. I remember when I was in medical school being taught about being careful to first do no harm. And that whole concept of iatrogenic conditions, that means things that we, the doctors, have caused, or the hospital treatment or your care. And it started feeling like there was probably something we were doing that was causing this to happen, because kids were going along normal in their development and then they would just, boom, crash. I mean, just within days sometimes, or sometimes within months, lose language, lose eye contact. This was nothing we had ever seen before in medicine. And yet we were being told, don't worry, we don't know what it is, but it's not the vaccines. That was always the response. It's like, well, how do you know? Because nobody ever studied to take a look at, well, what is the difference between the vaccinated population and the unvaccinated population? And that is the root of the problem, Jonathan, is what medicine does to measure quality is we look at how well the doctor, in this case, or perhaps it's a hospital system, how well are you following protocols? That's how you're judged. So, for example, in the hospital I go to see newborns, the pediatricians in the hospital newborn unit is judged on how well they give the hepatitis B vaccine. In other words, if you have 90% uptake of that vaccine, the goal is 100%, you're a good doctor or you're a good hospital. Well, whether or not you take a medical product has nothing to do specifically with your health outcomes. That's what I was more interested in. So when I started seeing my patients just weren't doing very well, and I happened to be fortunate enough to have patients in my practice who were, the parents were choosing not to vaccinate. And early in my career, I was thinking they were nuts. I thought they were absolutely insane to be turning their backs on science, on what we knew was the most important thing a pediatrician could do, was to vaccinate these children, protect them from these diseases. I thought they were crazy, and I would tell them so. I literally believed that they were making a huge mistake, and I did everything in my power to convince them to do otherwise and follow the CDC schedule. I mean, every year, the Academy of Pediatrics, the AAP, and the CDC, Center for Disease Control in the US, would put their heads together and come up with a new schedule. What I realized after some time was, wait a minute, they're making new recommendations, but they never compared last year's schedule to this year's schedule and looked at all health outcomes. In fact, they've never looked at health outcomes comparing unvaccinated to vaccinated or partially vaccinated to fully vaccinated. So when you do your own deep dive into the research, you realize, oh my gosh, we've got a problem with this system. I wrote a book, The Vaccine Friendly Plan, in 2016. It's got some of the data that I had permission through an IRB, Institutional Review Board approved look at the data in my practice. And it indeed showed that there was almost no autism in the unvaccinated and a lot of health problems in the vaccinated. So that was sort of the first attempt to get some information to the world. I actually wrote it up for publication. I just didn't have the chops to get it through the peer review process. So I just wrote the book. Well, then in 2018, the Oregon Medical Board started coming after me with just a sequence of requests, mostly fishing for information. And they asked for, the one that just stood out was, prove to us that the vaccine-friendly plan is as safe as the CDC schedule.
But the fact that you made a stand and the power of what you came out with to show that unvaccinated children were, in fact, healthier than vaccinated children. Right. So yeah, please continue with that.
Sure. Okay. So yes, it's what ended up happening was, so with this Oregon Medical Board, and they have the power to take my license, which actually I'll get to, they did. They wanted to know, okay, well, how are your kids doing? That's a reasonable question. It kind of made me laugh because I thought to myself, well, they've never proven that the CDC schedule 1 year to the next was any better than the old one. But nevertheless, I thought, okay, actually somebody gave me this idea. I wished I'd thought of it myself. They said, why don't you do a quality analysis? Look at your data and see what you find. Brilliant. I wished I had thought of it myself. So I did. I hired an outside expert. This was a pediatrician, neonatologist, informatics expert. And I said, just come in, pull all the data, and let's see what we find. And that's what he did. And that resulted in the publication. Oh, I thought I had it here. Yes, I do. You may have seen this image here. So this is the study. All right. It's the relative incidence of office visits and cumulative rates of billed diagnoses along the axis of vaccination. And the orange lines are the vaccinated kids. The blue lines are the unvaccinated kids for numerous conditions. And you can probably put the link to your viewers of that article.
Absolutely.
This is the largest real-world study of actual patients comparing unvaccinated to variably vaccinated kids. And we say variably vaccinated because in my practice, we honor the informed consent process, which means you, the parent, decide each and every time whether or not you're going to get a vaccine, how many you're going to get. We present the CDC schedule as the recommended schedule, but then we go over the pros and cons of each vaccine and parents decide. Well, parents aren't going to make the same decision every time, so we have variable vaccination. And so that was the data we were working with. And it showed conclusively, with a very high statistical significance for most of the things we looked at, that the unvaccinated just were so much better off as far as health outcomes. And those are the parameters we should be looking at in medicine. I mean, if you're a child, if you're a parent, you want your child to be healthy. It doesn't matter whether or not they followed a protocol. It matters that they're healthy. And so it's time for us to just get away from, you know, uptake of products as our measure of how good we are and look at real outcomes. So within about 5 days after this article was available online, the Oregon Medical Board had an emergency meeting and suspended my license. They said I was a threat. I was a danger to society, is what they said.
To their schemes and the ways that, you know, so it's like the truth is always there and hidden in plain sight. Like, this guy is a danger to everything we've been doing and all the kinds of things that we had been planning. Uncontended up until this point. It's such a shock that someone would contend this.
Yeah, it was an inconvenient truth, right? So you've got data that's highly inconvenient to a system that makes billions, if not trillions, clearly trillions, if you count all the chronic disease that is created by, you know, our health system. Again, as I started off, iatrogenic, we cause these problems. Well, we now know the mechanisms by which vaccinating very young children too many too fast, and what's in the vaccines is causing the health problems that we're seeing. We know that there are direct toxins. Aluminum is a big one. There's also formaldehyde. There used to be mercury in vaccines. There are so many different things in the vaccines that we know about. With the current COVID vaccines, I'm told that there are some proprietary ingredients that we don't even know what they are. So then you're accepting a vaccine that
like graphene oxide?
Yeah, I learned about that recently. It's like, wow, there's some scary things in some of these vaccines. So that's a big issue. And then there's the whole mechanism of immune activation. When you give too many things too soon, overactivate the immune system, that can cause autoimmune conditions. Molecular mimicry can cause autoimmunity. So you have understood mechanisms by which vaccines are problematic. We now have the data, both from my study and then recently this past year, the control group came out with data. You can go to thecontrolgroup.org for that whole huge data set. And it's now becoming clear. It's not just a theory. It's now pretty much a fact that we've got a problem.
Let's go back to this report for a second. So what, for those that are either skeptical or just cannot believe that it's possible that unvaccinated children could be healthier than vaccinated children, what are some of the key takeaways? Why is that so clear for you in your research and why is that so clear to you?
Okay. So first of all, I was skeptical myself, right? So I went to medical school in the United States, Dartmouth Medical School. I was taught with what other pediatricians are taught. And in fact, students are taught this in grade school. Vaccines save lives. Vaccines are safe and effective, which by the way is a marketing slogan, not a fact. And we're just sort of indoctrinated by everything we read and hear that vaccines are safe and they're wonderful and we don't want to go back to the dark ages, right? So that is an entire paradigm, a belief system that you would have to be willing to reconsider, to take a look at that belief system if you're going to challenge it, right? You have to consider that, could I be wrong about that? So how did I come to understand that maybe I was wrong? It was my patients. I owe it all to be the fact that I'm a pediatrician who pays attention to the patients in front of me, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I serve a population that some would call alternative. So I did not talk these patients into not vaccinating, or I did not talk them out of vaccinating. I was a full-blown Academy of Pediatrics, board-certified pediatrician who believed in vaccines. But in front of me were several, probably a few hundred. I mean, initially, I think I only had a couple hundred families that weren't vaccinating out of several thousand. But it was enough for me to notice, wow, these kids never get sick. They just weren't getting sick. They weren't having any chronic disease. There was no diabetes. There was no ADD or ADHD, no autism, no eczema. Well, occasional eczema, but no asthma, none of the serious stuff. And then through my career over the last decade and a half, I had more and more and more patients wanting to slow down the vaccines. This coincided with the time I became aware that, wow, we do have a problem with what we're injecting. So when I started looking at my own data, and it was a large data set, over 3,000 kids all born into my practice, that was to alleviate confounding variables of patients joining the practice who were already vaccine injured or otherwise might complicate the data. So when I saw that data, which I've shown you here that you can look at, as you can see in this screen, the orange line represents the variably vaccinated children in the practice. The blue line is the unvaccinated. And these children were age matched because I have more younger kids who are unvaccinated than older, just because the trend over the last 13 years has been towards less and less vaccines as people sort of wake up to the risks. So to account for that and make sure we were comparing oranges to oranges, we picked the vaccinated kid who was exactly the same age as the unvaccinated. And so that's how we used that data. And here you see for asthma, you know, starting almost at just less than a year old, the vaccinated just skyrockets. And the unvaccinated have a tiny bit of asthma. And the same is true for allergic rhinitis, breathing issues, behavioral issues. For ADD and ADHD, you can see it's they're both the same up until about, a little less than 1,500 days. So that's around, we got 365 days in a year. So that would be around four, five, six. When you start diagnosing ADD, ADHD, you don't diagnose it before that. But the fascinating thing about this data here was we had zero, look at that, zero ADD or ADHD in the unvaccinated. Now that actually was surprising to me. I just had not been aware of that until I saw this data. But it speaks to the fact that something is going on with vaccines affecting our children's brains. And, you know, we can hypothesize all we want, but that data is pretty solid. And you can see with behavioral issues the same thing. So if your brain is being affected in some way, I did not present the autism data in this way because it wasn't as dramatic or significant. We only wanted to show what was highly significant, but we did find that our autism rate in our practice was less than half of that out in the public, for even for the vaccinated, because they're following a slower schedule. But there you can see the allergy things, eczema, dermatitis, urticaria, similar pattern, the vaccinated having a lot more than the unvaccinated. If you look at anemia there, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? So something happened right there at 9 months. I can tell you what that is. In pediatrics, we screen 9-month-olds for anemia. And that's why you see all of a sudden, bam, at 9 months old, the vaccinated develop anemia. The unvaccinated, a small percentage get anemia. And there's some theories as to why that might be, but the fact that that's happening is real. Pediatricians, since the time I graduated from medical school 35 years ago, have known that infants who are anemic have problems with brain function, brain development, neurodevelopment. So here we've got a real clear-cut evidence that something is going on in the highly vaccinated children that's causing anemia. Folks, this is real-world data. This is not a most of the vaxxed, unvaxxed studies that are published are compilations and meta-analysis, and it's very easy to manipulate that sort of data and come out with results that really don't represent real world. This is just plain old, here it is. This is what we found in these patients.
Wow, thank you so much. And tell me the number of people in this.
You can see that we had 3,324 patients left in that visit. Actually, if you look at figure two, it's simple to follow it. You can see that there were 561 unvaccinated patients. You know, the kids who got zero vaccines, 561, two vaccines, about 100. And then across the board, you know, you had all the way up to, you know, quite a few got 28, 30, and then it tails off. Nobody got 40 or more. The full schedule would be about 70 vaccines. But because this was data of those patients born into my practice, the oldest kid in this practice was about 11. And that's why you won't see any numbers greater than that. And it shows that we have very few who got the full schedule, but some do, right? It's all about informed consent. This is what is so worrisome about the rollout of the COVID vaccine and this emergency use authorization that's happened, so that by doing that, people can be made to feel as if they don't have a choice.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's key for people to understand that you can say that they have choice, but then use such social pressure that it makes it impossible for people. So I look at what you showed me here on page 14, and I just feel like shouting this from the rooftops. These stats on ADD, ADHD, my wife has struggled with that her whole life. We looked at her vaccine reports from when she was an infant, and she had seizures on the days of the vaccine once or twice in looking through her report. So having a seizure on the day of your vaccine shows an injury, yeah. Correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And the unfortunate thing with vaccines is, for whatever reason, physicians generally don't make the connection that the vaccine, even though it temporarily preceded the symptom, like your wife's case, right? She had a vaccine, mm-hmm. She had a seizure. That should be a no-brainer, slam dunk. The vaccine probably caused the seizure. But we deny it. We say, oh, it's a coincidence. And most of the time, those coincidences are never reported to the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, VAERS. And therefore, we don't collect the data to ever know what's going on because vaccines are just presumed to be safe and effective. So what you're looking at is the total amount of aluminum that is retained within the child's body for the first 800 days of their life, okay? So 2.5 years. And the red line represents the adult maximum amount of aluminum that's considered safe. The blue line is the 50th percentile, so the average safe level for children based on their age, and you'll see that's the blue line. Now, if you look at the spikes, the yellow and black is the CDC schedule. Yellow is a CDC schedule where I picked intentionally those vaccines that were available that contained the least amount of aluminum. In other words, if I was going to give the CDC schedule, in some instances you have a choice of which brands you can pick. I would pick the brands that had the least amount of aluminum and you would have those yellow spikes. The black lines represent picking the CDC schedule using those products that have more aluminum. And you can see on those spikes would be representing 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, with those tiny little green ones, 5 months, 7 months, 9 months, because with the vaccine-friendly plan, we split out the aluminum-containing vaccines and we only give one aluminum-containing vaccine at a time. Basically, what you're seeing in this graph is that in the CDC schedule on vaccine days, you're not only massively exceeding pediatric safe levels, you're exceeding adult safe levels in a 2-month-old. It's just a massive dose of a neurotoxin, aluminum.
Wow.
Go to the next bar graph that's right under that one. And this just shows the same data in a slightly different way. So what we looked at here in the first graph on the left, if you look at the first 7 months of an infant's life, on the CDC schedule, you are spending 25 to 70% of those first 7 months above the safe level for aluminum. So you're basically thrusting that child into a toxic level of aluminum for most of their life, for the first 7 months. In the vaccine-friendly plan, it's more like 5 or 6%. The second graph is just if you look at the whole first 2 years, that's how much time of your first 2 years you're spending above safe levels. This is shocking. This should be enough. This article, believe it or not, is still in print. In other words, they haven't pulled this one. I don't know why. I think they can't because it's a model. So anybody's allowed to model what's going on, right? It's not like we're... There's nothing but modeling what's actually in the vaccines. And so, but this should have been a wake-up call that we've got a problem with aluminum in our vaccine system. We had the same thing happen with mercury back in around the year 2000 when somebody finally did the analysis of how much mercury was in vaccines. It was, oh my gosh, we were exceeding safe levels of mercury. And the reason that happened was as we added more and more vaccines to the schedule, a lot of them having mercury, we got to this insane overdose of mercury, a horrible neurotoxin. And overnight almost, in 2001, 2002, they got the mercury out of the vaccines, except for the multi-dose flu shot. That's worth your listeners knowing. If you're going to get a flu shot, make sure it's a single dose, not a multi-dose vial.
Thank you. Yep. Thankfully, it even states that on the CDC website. So at the moment, anyway.
Yeah.
But again, people aren't going to ask for that. So thank you. That's really, really helpful. Like, I mean, at this point in time, what would you say now? Is it better not to vaccinate? Do the children have better possibilities of warding off those other diseases using natural medicine, like let's say, for example, you mentioned vitamin D. Are these better treatments to fortify the body? Is a healthy body a better answer? What do you think?
Well, Jonathan, I think that's a really difficult question. I got my license reinstated just this past month with the stipulation that I cannot discuss vaccines. So obviously, I can't give any health recommendations. This is just a show. We're just talking theoretical. It's informational. I'm not giving medical recommendations. I think the data on the overall harm caused by vaccines and the entire program is so convincingly worrisome that it would not be unreasonable for a parent to say, you know what, I'm not satisfied that the risks of the vaccines are low enough that I'm willing to take those chances, right? I'm willing to take the chances of these diseases for which we have vaccines. Now, you know, the fear is, oh my, these diseases are going to come back. Well, if everybody stopped vaccinating, like if we just pick today and we're gonna no more vaccines on the planet, there will be a return of things like measles, mumps, and rubella. That will return. I lived before the era of vaccines for measles, mumps, rubella. And rubella was no big deal. I mean, you don't want to get it while you're pregnant, but beyond that, it's no big deal. Same with mumps. For the most part, it was no big deal. Measles has a death rate. It's, frankly, some, like myself, would consider that death rate from measles probably would be acceptable, because now we know that if you have adequate vitamin A levels, that death rate goes to almost zero. So I think it's an avoidable death if you know how to manage it. But we don't know, right? So
that's the reason why they WHO say that it's only fatalities only really happen with measles in developing countries with people that are severely malnourished. And right. So then you got to fix the malnourishment problem. The child isn't going to then magically get healthy. Oh, let's go vaccinate all those children. Well, no, right. Let's get them healthy. And but go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, we've had no deaths in the U.S. In over a decade from measles, and yet we have hundreds. The bad year we were over 1,000, but usually several hundred cases a year of measles. There have been no deaths, so it's not generally a fatal disease in a country where your nutrition is good, your healthcare system is good. So one would have to look at it disease by disease, but honestly, a person could make a case for the fact that, you know, I'm going to trust my natural immunity, I'm going to eat healthy, I'm going to avoid toxins, and I'll be okay. And yep, you probably would be okay.
And some of the issues there that I think that people don't think enough about is the carcinogens and the fact that we have 1 in 2 men getting cancer in their lifetime and 1 in 3 females getting cancer in their lifetime. And then the onslaught of neurodegenerative disease, where 1 in 3 seniors are dying of Alzheimer's or dementia. And I think about these statistics and I think about what is it that we're doing that's contributing to this onslaught. And I'm not blaming one particular thing. I am attributing this to an accumulation of toxins in the body that create within the body an overload that then makes it impossible. Because we know that autoimmunity basically precedes cancer, and autoimmunity is the root of neurodegenerative disease, in that the body is attacking when it's not supposed to attack, allegedly. But what's it attacking? It's toxins and then a weakened defense. I've seen studies that have shown people with autoimmune disease have a 5 times greater likelihood of getting cancer in their life. So these are the things that I think about. Do you have concerns about that for the future of the children in the diseases that are very difficult to either overcome, or they have high fatalities? Do you see these problems?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, children are not healthy today, and over 50% have chronic conditions. There was virtually no one in my childhood who had a chronic condition. I'm 64 years old. So in just 2 generations, we have completely transformed the picture of what it's like to be unhealthy instead of healthy. So we can go back to wellness. Thank you, Jonathan. I know this is what you're doing. This is what you're about, is we have to teach people how you can be well, how you can be healthy. And believe it or not, the power is in your hands.
So Dr. Malone, Did you look into any of his stuff just recently, Dr. Robert Malone, where he's the inventor, allegedly, of mRNA technology? Anyway, maybe that's for a future time when you have some. It was just June 11th where he was talking with Steve Ursh, and it was a very interesting interview. He seems, to me, like, to be honest, I was expecting a bit of a Dr. Evil kind of inventor of the mRNA. Like, this is not good. Like, just stop, please. Like, and I'm surprised personally that he doesn't have some remorse for the role he's played in this. But in terms of him intentioning this type of thing and the fact that he's whistleblowing, I think is very powerful still to reflect on. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on what's going on there.
I listened to about half of that lecture because I haven't had the time to do the rest of it. But I very much liked the discussion between those three, because what they brought up is that there's some anomalies within the system that you should be able to talk about anything, and you can't talk about any possible adverse effects. And I loved that these guys were doing everything in their scientific power to have a reasonable discussion, because I hadn't seen that ever. All three very, very smart people. And I think, you know, a lot of bad stuff is done in the name of science. Just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. They talked about that as well. So it was kind of like an ivory tower discussion that was made kind of come down to earth a little bit.
Yeah, such a good point. And it was the real deal. And I think that with this discussion around mRNA and the fact that he's talking about the issue with the spike proteins embedding themselves in all organs across the body, and this is coming out from multiple sources right now, mainstream, credible for the general public to say, hey, look, well, shouldn't I be concerned about this? And he's alerting people versus, telling people that this is safe and effective. Any word on what's coming out about the spike protein and how it's affecting the body and what it's actually doing to people?
Well, the spike protein appears to be the problem. There are 50 billion spike proteins in each shot. It looks like the very thing that caused COVID, the disease, was the spike protein. And now that spike protein, when it's injected into the body in the form of a shot, it cross-reacts with 28 different human tissues, one of which is the ovaries, and a placental tissue called syncytin. And so the miscarriage rate is up 700%. My group at MAM, Millions Against Medical Mandates, has put together a survey called MyCycleStory.com, because we're seeing so many women who are having miscarriages, losing pregnancies, little girls bleeding, vaginal bleeding in a 16-month-old who's just spent a weekend with her recently vaccinated grandparents. That's the spike protein, we think, transmitting itself from the skin, from the urine, from the sweat, from the breath. We don't know, so we're trying to collect data on that.
Yeah, fantastic. And with women and their cycles, you're speaking about that, the miscarriages, fertility, these things are all, it appears there's reports coming out of fertility clinics, and I can't verify them because they're anonymous, but that the sperm donors and the egg donors from previously fertile people are completely infertile on both accounts, and this is actually unanimous. This particular one that came out, again, it was anecdotal. Well, it was anonymous. So, have you seen anything in regard to your male fertility as well, or any of the stats emerging from some of these places, like fertility clinics or anything like that?
Well, we've definitely seen that. And my colleague, Dr. Larry Pilevsky, says he has seen infants with scrotal rashes and little girls with labial rashes, again, just from being around recently vaccinated people. Also, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny notes that there is a protein called flagellin in the mRNA jabs, And flagellin is absolutely essential. You know, the sperm has a tail on it, a flagellate for swimming. And if you've got antibodies against that, and we know that there are ACE receptors on sperm, and the spike protein sits on the ACE receptor, so there's every reason to believe that this thing is designed to cause infertility. Why do you think there's such a massive push to jab 12 to 15-year-olds now? This is insane. It's insane. Children don't get COVID. They don't transmit COVID. Why are we suddenly saying all these 12 to 15-year-olds need to get the shot? They go through puberty. It looks like what we're going to create is a whole world of eunuchs.
Wow. And I wonder what the gender would be there. We've heard about depopulation and this type of thing. Why make people infertile? Why would people do that? And then pregnant women, what would you like to say in regards to, we talked a bit about pregnant women, I know, and any other information there to pregnant women?
Pregnant women, you're creating a set of eyes, two kidneys, a pancreas, small intestine, a brain, a pineal gland. Your body's doing that automatically through your relationship with God. Why in the name of all that is holy would you ever let yourself be injected with a DPT shot, with a flu shot? Why would you let your newborn have a hepatitis B shot when you're worried about tuna and mercury in fish? Why would you ever allow yourself to be injected with something like this? Why? Wake up that mother bear instinct. Please do that.
So I'm a graduate of the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor here in the U.S. Did a general surgical training, which I actually left after about 3 years to pursue integrative medicine. Got myself trained in that. I am now both board certified in emergency medicine, which is what I did for over 25 years, as well as integrative medicine, which I'm going on 32, 33 years of that at this point. So my practice originally was aimed at trying to discover the underlying causes of illness and then treating those underlying causes. And really what dragged me into this whole arena of vaccines and vaccine injuries were first my patients who were showing up with these things, and then also my lovely wife who dragged me kicking and screaming into this whole world. And maybe she can tell you that story as to how I ended up here. But basically she's the one who said, honey, we're gonna go save the babies. And that got me into the world of autism. And you don't have to go very far in that world before you find parents that will swear to their dying breath that it was a vaccine that caused their child's autism, you know, that they were normal until vaccine X, Y, or Z, and they regressed, they disappeared, and they became autistic. And it really doesn't matter how many papers you read or how many statements from the CDC you get, you end up in a situation where, you know, either there's mass delusion or there's something going on. And that's really what got me into the research, and Trish has done so much more than I have, but that's gotten me into the research, and COVID's just opened a whole new book, and we can certainly talk about that. So right now, I no longer practice ER. I'm primarily just in my office. I serve as a expert witness for vaccine injury cases in the United States, even in Canada. You know, I've testified for the or written opinions for the our vaccine court, the special masters of whatever the vaccine court's official name is. But that's the only avenue in the United States for vaccine injury. So I've got a lot of experience firsthand with patients, and then also in the literature doing the research. And, you know, I'll let Trish sort of fill in where she came from and how she got involved with this, and also how she got me dragged into the CDC and all those kinds of things.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
So, Jonathan, I'm a registered nurse. I've been a nurse for over 26 years. I actually went back and obtained my master's degree in pediatric nurse practitioner in 2014. Currently, I'm working as the office manager, kind of running the practice. But I spent over 17 years working in the emergency room as an emergency room nurse. I very much was pro-vaccine. I vaccinated myself. I vaccinated all my children, never questioned them. And as I was working in the ER, I started having some of the younger physicians and nurses come into the ER, and they were having children that were diagnosed with autism. And that was kind of unheard of in my age group with the nurses that were my age and our kids. And so one of the nurses came up to me, you know, one day and really asked me if I would ask my husband about trying some alternative diets and supplements for her son who had been diagnosed with autism. And I really didn't know much about autism. I asked my husband and he's like, yeah, she should try. It's not going to hurt. It might help. And then just fast forward over the course of a year or so, I started learning more about autism and patients that were looking to try things to improve their condition. And a lot of those things we were doing for our adult patients at my husband's office. And so I just started digging more into autism, and that's kind of what got me on this road. And through that, I started talking with parents who were saying their child was, you know, developing normal, was neurotypical, had language, had eye contact, and received a set of vaccines and regressed and were diagnosed with autism. And I really didn't necessarily even believe that as I heard these stories. And I thought, you know, this can't be. Vaccines are safe. We, you know, this would be damaging all the kids if it was the vaccines. All the kids are getting vaccinated. So I started digging around a little bit and became very concerned with what I was finding, with the lack of actual real science that supports the safety of vaccinating children. And told my husband that if you're doing this for the adults, you got to come save the babies. And I signed him up to go to a conference in New Jersey through DAN, Defeat Autism Now. They're no longer active, but they were back in 2007. And off we went on our journey, and here we are.
Awesome. Well, I'm very grateful that you guys took that journey, and it certainly wasn't the easy one. It's certainly not the blue pill. It was the red pill that you took, and it's a hard pill to swallow because you have to deal with a lot of pain. And that's what you guys know really well. You got to deal with a lot of heartbreak, and it'd be so easy to just turn the blind eye to that. And like, you guys have really successful careers and opportunities in front of you, and there's lots of different financial incentive trails that you could go down to take care of things and have everything fine. But then there was a calling, and I think it's a God-given calling personally. And I think that these are the things that are the reasons why we're here and why this is so relevant to the world. And here we are joining forces to get this message out and help warn people in regards to the coronavirus vaccine. But it really gives me the opportunity to say, hey, look, what have we been ignoring? What has been point blank in our face for the last 30 years or 150 years? You know, like, I'll let you guys take me back, but I mean, I'm talking about even just when the vaccine adverse reporting system is set up and we're getting data coming back. And I mean, this is age old, and it's just so sad that the data and the stories and the suffering has been ignored so long. And now look at what's happening. And then everyone, yeah. And still a lot of people aren't coming full circle. Let's get back to this technology. What has been happening for so long in regard to this technology? It's not just the coronavirus vaccine. And because of this, I fear that a lot of people will be like, oh, well, look, this mRNA tech is not great. Let's go and do the Novavax because other vaccines are safe and effective. And then we're just straight back down the same rabbit hole. Like, wake up from the delusion, people. And we need people like yourself to help us with that and give us the science. So Dr. New, where would you like to start with that?
Well, I mean, I would really start with the whole idea of vaccine safety and how traditional vaccines, let's not talk COVID just yet, how traditional vaccines had been evaluated and approved by the FDA. Because I think one of the things that dragged Trish into this was she saw a lecture where this person presented a bunch of facts, and she spent the whole hour saying, that can't be true, that can't be true, that can't be true, until she researched it. And there's so many mind-blowing things in traditional vaccines that people just don't know. I mean, I listened to some of the sort of big names in the COVID world, and they think that vaccines in pregnant women have been exhaustively evaluated, and they haven't. You know, you go to the CDC website, over 1 million women have been studied with vaccines, either for Tdap or the flu vaccine. Over 1 million women have been studied. But out of those over 1 million women, exactly 33 have been studied where what's the outcome for the child? Because we worry about vaccinating pregnant women because it can affect the development of that child's brain. And it can cause things like neurodevelopmental delay and asthma and autoimmunity and that sort of thing for the child. So there's one study with 33 women out of those over 1 million women that they supposedly studied. And the joke is there were 33 women that where they looked at the outcome after being vaccinated while pregnant. There were 15 women in the control group, and all the neurodevelopmental delays, and they were checked at 14 months. How do you diagnose autism at 14 months? But they were checked at 14 months, and the three neurodevelopmental delay risk children were all in the vaccinated group. But guess what? If you only got 33 people, you can't show statistical significance. So the conclusion of the paper is, hey, there's no link. And this is what we see over and over and over again. You know, I went to, this was another thing Trish dragged me to. You have to go to the ASAP, to the Advisory Council on Immunization Practices meetings. It's like, I don't want to go to ASAP. I've heard some of them. They make me crazy. And it's like, no, you need to go. And I went there and just called them out and said, you guys are doing junk science. This would not be published anywhere else in the scientific literature if it was not on vaccines. And the logic and reasoning that they use is just crazy. So when you're looking at traditional vaccines, you look at like the hepatitis B, studied for 4 and 5 days for safety. Studied according to the package insert, this is what they use for FDA approval, 147 babies and children, like up to 10 years old. We still don't know how many babies this was studied in. You know, we give it to newborns in the United States, right? So you get it when they're newborn. We have no idea of the safety. Nobody's looking at the long-term outcomes of any of these things. But the mainstream docs who have seen the light with the COVID vaccine need to understand the entire schedule is like this with very limited safety. And, you know, again, most of these things are, if they're evaluated for safety, it's a few days, maybe 42 days. That's when they check antibodies. So they'll have people check in at 42 days. But none of these are studied for years. We have no idea what the long-term side effects are. We have no idea. I mean, a simple question. Are we healthier for vaccinating? We should know the answer to that. We don't.
Yeah. And the Institute of Medicine has actually evaluated vaccine safety numerous times since I think 1991 was their first review of vaccine safety and concerns about vaccines. And they've, you know, been asked several times about the safety of the schedule. And there's no research, there's no published studies looking at the outcomes for numerous things that we see in our children. So in 2011, the Institute of Medicine did a report, and they found for like 86% of all the conditions they looked at that there was no evidence one way or the other if vaccines were causing it or not. And then in 2013, they were charged with kind of evaluating the schedule for safety, and they couldn't have any good concrete science to support the evidence of the schedule itself. And so the CDC formed a committee of experts, and they all got together and they decided how they could best do a study that would compare vaccinated children to unvaccinated children, completely unvaccinated children, for, you know, 20 different conditions, including all-cause mortality, seizures, SIDS, ADD, ADHD, asthma, allergies, the top 20 things that our children are afflicted by. And they published a white paper in 2015 telling the CDC how they could actually conduct this study and get a, you know, an idea of the outcomes in vaccinated, unvaccinated children. You know, typically when you're looking at the effects, particularly the long-term effects of an intervention, whether it's smoking cigarettes, drinking Diet Pop, exercising. You can't compare 5 cigarettes to 10 cigarettes or 5 minutes of exercise to 8 minutes of exercise. You really got to compare the intervention that you're evaluating compared to none, compared to not doing the intervention. And so, you know, that's been 5-6 years that paper was published, and the CDC still has not conducted, or if they have, they have not published the results of those health outcomes in vaccinated and unvaccinated children. And that's key to long-term safety. You can look at a vaccine for 42 days and go back in 6 months and say, has anything changed? Do you have any new medical conditions? No, that's it. They're done. You know, but it's equivalent to following a smoker for 6 months. You've got to look at the long term, and you've got to look at not one vaccine compared to another, or 8 vaccines versus 7 vaccines, or a combination vaccine versus the individual components of that vaccine for the safety of it. So it's one of the big things that really concerns me about no long-term safety. And like, you know, people really think that those have been done. They think that studies have been done on SIDS. They think that studies have been done on seizures, you know, and some of these conditions that there's really no studies that have been done, at least in a way that is not easily manipulated. In other words, randomized placebo-controlled studies. And they think that, you know, it's ethical to either, as in the hepatitis B, have no placebo, or if you're evaluating the flu shot, that you compare it to a Tdap shot. I mean, it's not ethical, in my opinion, to give somebody a vaccine that they don't need to compare it to another vaccine instead of a saline shot. And that's what they do.
And with, you know, the flu vaccine, and this is one of the things that happened at ASAP. So one of the problems we have with the flu vaccine is it doesn't work well with the elderly. It just doesn't. And if anybody's in danger of the flu, it's the elderly. So they had a new quadrivalent, meaning there were 4 different targets in there, adjuvanted flu vaccine that they put into a trial. But they didn't compare it to another flu vaccine. They didn't compare it to a trivalent adjuvanted or quadrivalent non-adjuvanted. They compared it to a Tdap vaccine. So how can you tell if this new flu vaccine is any better than all the stuff you already have that you know doesn't work, unless you compare it? And they didn't. And this is where, I mean, just something really simple, something that every doctor out there knows. Vaccines don't cause autism. Every doctor knows that. And yet, when you actually go to the CDC website to look for the evidence of that, initially, they had a whole bunch of studies on the MMR vaccine, one vaccine, on thimerosal, one ingredient, and then they replaced that all with this horrible study from the head of vaccine safety, where they looked at the number of antigens that were given and compared it to the rate of autism and said there was no correlation, therefore vaccines don't cause autism. It's like crazy. They just make this stuff up. They try and come up with ways to prove that everything's safe rather than doing the simplest of all things, which is take the databases they already have. This is what this white paper said from 2015. You have the data, take the data from the database and evaluate. You've got enough unvaccinated kids in there. What are their health outcomes? You compare them to the health outcomes of the completely vaccinated kids. And if you want to throw in a third group, the partially vaccinated kids. You know, but really, you could do that study. You could do it in a week. And then they would shut us all up. If they showed that vaccinated kids are healthier than unvaccinated kids, and the any risk involved with vaccination is well worth the benefit you receive from it, then it would be easy to shut us up, but they won't do it. And all of us are saying, I wonder why, right? And then all of a sudden you have this vaccine, the COVID vaccine that is so much worse than any vaccine we've ever had. And now all of a sudden you have people from the mainstream going, well, you didn't test this. You didn't do animal testing. You didn't do any long-term trials. It's not like any other vaccine. Most vaccines are studied between 1 and 10 years. No, it takes them that long to develop it but they're actually studied for a few weeks in terms of safety outcomes. And that's just crazy.
So a bit of smoke and mirrors there across the board, things that make it appear as if there is a lot of safety being done here, a lot of precautions in place, a lot of observation, like the time that it takes to manufacture it and roll it out, and the business development of that process, and that's the time heavy part, the manufacturing. But then what you're saying is the actual process of monitoring the child. I believe our last conversation, you were saying that they monitor the child on the 42nd day, and then at 2 years, and then that's it. Or no, 6 months. What was the numbers?
Yeah. So like, if you look at the measles vaccine, what they did was they had the kids come back at 42 days to draw blood because they wanted to see if they had antibodies. And while they're there, they, you know, any adverse outcomes. That's how they got the side effect panel for that one. That was at 42 days, we're done. For hepatitis B, it was reported, they checked in with them for the first 4 days or 5 days, depending on which one you used. The one Trish was talking about was actually the HPV vaccine, which that one, they monitored them over the short term to look at who was responding, but then they also had a follow-up at 6 months, and I believe at a year on that one as well. But again, there's a recent MMR study, a big one, a legitimate study. But of course, it's a new MMR vaccine compared to the old MMR vaccine. And guess what? They had the same side effects. It's like, duh, a pack of Camel cigarettes versus a pack of Marlboro cigarettes. You have the same rate of cancer, therefore cigarettes don't cause cancer. That's their logic. But with that one, they did follow up at 6 months to see whether there are any new conditions. And what they found was like 3.5% of these kids had a new medical condition, chronic medical condition after the MMR vaccine. Why wouldn't that be shocking? You know, and most of that was eczema, and eczema is not a skin problem. Eczema is an immune system dysfunction, and it's linked with neurodevelopmental delay. It's linked with ADD. It's linked with autism, and they just sweep that under the rug. Everything's fine. You know, if you look at our schedule, there's a new combination vaccine called Vaxalis. Well, not so new. The FDA approved it a couple of years ago. It still hasn't been put on our schedule because when they compared, they had Vaxalis, which is 6 vaccines, and they compared to Pentacell, which is 5 vaccines, plus the hepatitis B, which is the one that was missing. They basically compared 6 to 6 along with the rest of the vaccine schedule. 93-94% of kids had an adverse event in both groups, but because it was the same, it's fine. 93%. I mean, it's crazy.
Did you see how the ACIP presentation gave numbers that make a positive case for giving the COVID injections to 12 to 17 year olds, but deliberately left out the numbers that showed that they were less likely, far less likely to suffer adverse reactions and death if they got the disease instead? They don't want to use the data to correctly compare the health outcomes of the vaccinated versus unvaccinated and even partially vaccinated kids. Does that make you wonder why? Here's what we covered in this episode. No genotoxicity or teratogenicity studies have been done on COVID vaccines. Studies show reduction in fertility in animals and high concentrations of the spike protein in ovaries. COVID-19 survivors get no benefit from the vaccines, only harm. There are no safety guardrails in place and no attempt to mitigate the risk to the public. The safety signal in January of 182 deaths should have shut down the program, but it didn't. It is verified that 86% of deaths reported in VAERS are from the vaccines. 50% occur within 48 hours and 80% within a week. The pre-hospital phase is the best time for therapeutic treatment of COVID. Hospitalization and late treatment is simply too late and has unacceptably high mortality. Early immunotherapy with a sequenced multi-drug approach supported by the best available evidence has a positive benefit to risk relationship and reduces hospitalization and death. The vaccine causes the body to generate the spike protein. It's dangerous, damages blood vessels, and causes blood clotting. That's the last thing you want circulating in the placenta or to the baby. COVID-19 is an easily treatable problem in pregnancy. why risk the vaccine? If you're healthy, you will most likely recover from COVID with no problems. We are now seeing way more deaths from the vaccine than from COVID. It's unknown what's going to happen to vaccinated people now or in the future if exposed to COVID. Doctors fear pathogenic priming, which may cause a worse outcome if a vaccinated person is later exposed to the virus. Postmenopausal women, chemo-treated people in their 80s, children, and 18-month-olds experience bleeding from their vagina. Clinicians get strange rashes, very abnormal bleeding, decidual casts after being in close proximity to vaccinated people, tens of thousands of reported cases. We will continue this work and continue to support you as you go through this journey. And as we go, I want to remind you that you can own this series today. You'll be immediately plugged in to get all our new updates as we go into the very near future, as we go through the next weeks and months ahead with the experts that will be sharing more with you as we cross the next step. So I want you to have access to that, and I'm just letting you know that you can take advantage of that during this special screening at the discounted prices with all the free gifts, including the special updates as we go on this journey together. So thank you so much for considering supporting our mission. I can't wait to see you in the next episode.